It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Since taking office, President Trump has proposed massive changes to the U.S. Postal Service, moves which could disrupt mail service in Wisconsin and beyond.
He's called for a, quote, form of a merger between the Postal Service and the Commerce Department. A major reorganization or privatizing the Postal Service could result in the biggest changes to USPS since it became independent more than 50 years ago.
Later this month, the National Association of Letter Carriers will hold nearly 200 rallies across the country and in Wisconsin to protest against any moves to restructure USPS. Don Annan is a letter carrier and president of the Wisconsin State Association of Letter Carriers Union. Don, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Morning. Thank you for having me.
And we also have Russell Berman with us, staff writer at The Atlantic. His recent piece is called What Happens If Trump Comes for the Mail? Russell, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Russell, let's start with you. You've talked with lawmakers and union officials. You've talked with advocates for the Postal Service from both political parties about privatizing USPS. What did they tell you about efforts to merge with the Commerce Department?
Well, I have yet to find anyone who thinks this would be a good idea, that this would improve mail service. You know, to the contrary, almost all of them expressed concerns that it would worsen the trends that we've seen over the past decade or two, where cutbacks in service have hit disproportionately rural areas and rural districts the most. And part of that is that the Commerce Department, it's a government agency, but it's not one of the biggest ones. It's, according to the people that I've talked to, just not equipped to handle the enormity of what the U.S. Postal Service is. The Postal Service delivers nearly half of the entire world's mail, and its network dwarfs that of, private carriers like FedEx and U.S. and UPS. So it would be a huge change, and according to the people that I've talked to, not one for the better.
You also heard that this potentially could be a step toward privatization. Why would a postal service that's under the umbrella of a Commerce Department be different or move toward privatization?
Well, basically, it would be under the thumb of President Trump and potentially Elon Musk and the Department of Government Efficiency. And so, it could be subject to cuts. And two, just being instead of being the independent agency with its own board of governors that it's been since a reorganization that you alluded to in 1970, by making it just another cabinet department, it would give the president and the executive branch more authority to potentially sell off or privatize parts of it. It would just make it easier because it would subject it more directly to presidential control. And Trump has made no secret of his hostility toward the Postal Service. He called it a joke during his first term, and he's really never stopped musing about how it could be shaken up or, as he's acknowledged, privatized.
Don, let's turn to you and your thoughts on this independent agency. Why should people be concerned in this moment if the Postal Service would become part of the Commerce Department?
Well, if it became part of the Commerce Department, it would sharply reduce all the service to rural America. That's including 51.5 million addresses where private carriers do not deliver. You know, every day, over 200,000 letter carriers deliver 360 million pieces of mail. That's nearly 169 million delivery points, supporting a $1.92 trillion mailing industry. And I'm sure that's why, they're very interested in trying to privatize the post office. They'd have to eliminate the Board of Governors, and they have oversight, and that would be they would need an act of Congress to do that. The post office has been a service for over 250 years, and they hit every location in all 50 states and all U.S. territories. And it's older, really, than the whole country itself. if you try to privatize this company, it would have 640,000 postal jobs would be lost, including over 73,000 veterans. This only not only would be illegal, but this is unconstitutional.
You alluded to this before, but what could happen to last mile postal delivery, which USPS plays such a big role in, this final delivery point to someone's door, regardless of their location?
Yeah, they wouldn't have that. You know, if you look at postal service in other countries that don't have the last mile, or they don't have the postal service that delivers to the rural community, they'll have to go, you know, hours to these postal hubs or mailbox centers to try to get their mail. Think about all the elderly and the medicine that we deliver. You know, that would be impossible for some people to even actually get the services that they need.
We're talking about how the U.S. Postal Service could face substantial changes in this Trump administration and the potential impact here in Wisconsin. And we have Don Annan with us, letter carrier and president of the Wisconsin State Association of Letter Carriers. Russell Berman is here, staff writer for The Atlantic. Russell, what financial challenges has the Postal Service been up against in recent years?
Well, there's obviously been a huge shift from, you know, people no longer, and for many decades, of course, have not been sending letters. They've been using email and going to online billing. That's had a huge impact on the Postal Service. And of course, they've been at the same time, they've been ordering more packages. And so a bigger part of the Postal Service's business is package delivery, as opposed to simple mail and letters and Christmas cards and the like. And so adjusting to that shift in the economy, as well as facing more competition from private carriers, you know, has had an impact on the Postal Service, and they've also faced other challenges. In 2006, Congress passed a bill that required the Postal Service to prepay billions of dollars every year into their healthcare pension program. And that basically contributed to the fact that the Postal Service went through many years of losses. It was just very difficult to make a profit when you combine the challenges in the industry and the economy, including the, you know, the financial crisis in 2008, the pandemic in 2020, with these this requirement that they spend or pay billions of dollars that they really didn't have. And so that's resulted in cutbacks. The Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, who was controversial when President Trump, when his appointees on the Board of Governors appointed him as Postmaster General in 2020. He's had this 10-year plan delivering for America. And a few years in, it really, you know, the reviews have not been very good, because there have been continuing complaints about rural service and you know, just a decline in how the Postal Service operates.
And now DeJoy has announced his plans to step down as Postmaster General. What impact do you think could his departure have in this moment when USPS is in flux?
Well, you're right. It's a very uncertain moment. You know, some people are happy about it, including some Republicans. Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri took DeJoy to task in December at a congressional hearing, basically saying he's lost patience with him. Some Democrats have never warmed up to him. And so, you know, without Trump's intervention, if he does nothing, the Postal Service Board of Governors will choose the next Postmaster General. But there is this cloud hanging over, which is what might Trump try to do via executive order, which would spur a whole another round of court challenges. You know, and so there's just a lot of uncertainty there.
Don, another development here is this suggestion from the Commerce Secretary that America's mail carriers should help conduct the 2030 census. Your thoughts there?
That's really silly, because anybody that actually knows anything about delivering the mail knows that the letter carriers do not have time to go knocking on doors for census. You know, Russell talked about the change in the pandemic. You know, after COVID, the parcel delivery has quadrupled from what it used to be. I've been delivering mail excuse me, for over 34 years. And when I first started, the letter mail was just almost unattainable to carry. You'd have to split up relays because you'd have so many much letter. And now it's all packages. And the fact that everybody in the country now has changed to getting every single thing that you once had to go to the store to deliver, now it's in packages that we deliver. We have no time during the day to go knock on doors and be a census taker. We'd be out there for 24 hours a day.
And Russell, there was a Government Accountability Office report from 2011 that said it wouldn't be cost effective. Has anything changed?
It's unlikely. I mean, it's unclear how serious this idea is. I mean, the new Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, has talked about it as if it's, an idea that just popped into their heads and it's like, oh, maybe this would work, as opposed to an idea that's been, again, which has been studied, but it's unclear if they've read any of these studies or if they just think, it sounds like it might work. Let's try it.
Don, the National Association of Letter Carriers, local branches holding nearly 200 rallies on March 23rd. What do you hope to accomplish through these events?
Well, we want to bring our message to the public and to the people in Wisconsin and across the nation to say, hey, we want the post office to stay as it is. We're fighting to keep over 640,000 postal jobs. We want to uphold the universal service of delivering mail, city and rural wide, because our customers depend on this. We want to protect one of the nation's most loved public agency. Whenever you do any polls, the post office is considered and ranked one of the most trusted government agencies, because we're bipartisan.
And Donna, we're going to leave it there. Thank you both for joining us, Don Annan, letter carrier and president of the Wisconsin State Association of Letter Carriers, Russell Berman, staff writer at The Atlantic, who's been writing about this.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, supporters and allies of transgender people in Wisconsin talk about why this moment is so difficult.
But also trying to be aware of how bad it can get. This isn't the first big campaign against trans supportive healthcare that we've seen.
That conversation is ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 3 weeks from today, voters will pick a new state Supreme Court justice and decide the ideological balance of the court.
WPR is profiling both candidates in the race. Here's Rich Kramer's story about Brad Schimmel, the Waukesha County judge, former Republican Attorney General, hoping to end the court's liberal majority.
On a snowy February morning outside La Crosse, members of the county's Republican Party are gathered for an annual meeting. Their special guest is Brad Schimmel, the conservative candidate for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. They start with a prayer, talking about the fight against woke politics. As Schimmel begins to speak, he references a Bible reading about God expelling the serpent from the Garden of Eden.
I thought, there's a metaphor. That is not ancient history. That's right now. It's that serious. That's how high these stakes are.
Schimmel is just getting started. He describes the days before President Donald Trump was elected as a scary time when America walked to the edge of the abyss. He challenges Republicans to remind Trump supporters what it felt like to save America in November, and he urges them to convince voters to save Wisconsin this April.
3.4 million people voted for the November 5th election. 1.5 million of those are going to fall off for April 1st. Here's our mission. Get the most of our people to come back and do it again.
Schimmel's Wisconsin Supreme Court campaign against Dane County Judge Susan Crawford is officially nonpartisan, but he's regularly making appeals like this one to Republicans. GOP strategist Mark Grawl says Schimmel understands the political side of judicial races.
I believe this is going to be a very close race, but Brad Schimmel gives conservatives an opportunity to win that previous candidate did not.
Schimmel is a career prosecutor who served 8 years as Waukesha County District Attorney before winning his 2014 Attorney General race. He lost his re-election in 2018. As Attorney General, he signed on to a lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act, and more recently, he said he sees nothing wrong with a pre-Civil War law that once banned abortions. Schimmel says he has opinions, but they don't follow him into the courtroom.
On the bench, I enforce the law, I apply the law the way it's written, without regard to my personal opinions. That's the commitment every person who puts on the robe should make.
Unlike the last conservative to run for the court, former Justice Dan Kelly, Schimmel is taking donations directly from the state GOP. He says he respects Kelly's position, but times have changed.
The idea that court races are completely without any partisan influences, that's gone.
Some Republican activists are heeding Schimmel's call.
Hi, good morning. My name is Angela. I'm here from the Republican Party of Kenosha County.
Angela Kretschmer is in one of the teams of canvassers who fan out across Kenosha on a recent Saturday. She walks quickly between houses on a quiet cul-de-sac. A smartphone app shows red markers on homes where soft Republicans live. She says that means they vote, but not all the time.
I'm here to give you some information about local candidates that are running for an April 1st election.
Kretschmer says conservatives have been running hard over the past year, but some think last November's election was the finish line.
So we just have to remind them, yes, now we took our federal government back. It's now time to focus on local.
But Schimmel's race against Crawford has been quickly nationalized. A PAC funded by billionaire Elon Musk has reported spending millions on Schimmel's behalf. And as Musk's prominence has grown with his work cutting the federal budget, University of Wisconsin-La Crosse political science professor Anthony Chergosky says his support could cut both ways.
Elon Musk has quickly become a boogeyman for the Democratic Party. So his involvement in this election could actually, in a bit of a twist, help the Democratic Party fire up its base by indicating the stakes of this election.
When it comes to Musk, Schimmel says he appreciates support from anyone who will help him get the word out. The other side has been using these rules in winning court races. He says Republicans need to use them too. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, Republican bills in the state legislature would end gender-affirming care for people under 18.
And at the federal level, a lawsuit seeks to block President Trump's executive order that would broadly restrict access to gender-affirming health care for transgender young people. That order is currently on hold as the case moves through courts.
We're joined by Elise Cayley, president of the Washburn-Shawamigan Bay chapter of PFLAG that supports LGBTQ people, and Nora Huppert, a staff attorney at Lambda Legal. The firm is representing the national PFLAG organization in litigation. It involves transgender youth and their families whose health care would be disrupted by President Trump's executive order. We spoke last week, and Nora starts by explaining what's at stake in this federal case.
So the aspect of those orders that had the most immediate impact was a threat to withhold federal funding from institutions that provide gender-affirming medical care to patients under the age of 19. Clearly, the intended effect of this threat was to coerce medical institutions into canceling appointments. And in the days after the executive order was issued, we did see families across the country facing appointments canceled that they had been looking forward to for years. Chaos just sort of inflicted in the private medical lives and planning of families across the country. And so we filed a challenge to that aspect of the executive order in federal court, and we obtained a temporary restraining order blocking enforcement of that threat.
Elise, I want to turn to you as president of the Washburn-Shawamigan Bay chapter of PFLAG. Your chapter not directly involved in this litigation. The lawsuit is involving the national organization. But what impact would President Trump's executive order have on your community in far northern Wisconsin?
Great question. So up here, we actually do have a surprisingly strong LGBT community, and things are really welcoming up here. But we are fairly remote, and most of us get our health care from the same sources. It's going to be very, very hard on people if this is withheld. First of all, every medicine and most of the procedures they're trying to ban for trans people have been accepted for medical use for a long time and are actively being used for non-transgender or, you know, as we say, cisgender patients. If these drugs were actually dangerous, they'd keep cis teenagers from getting Lupron and they'd keep senior citizens from getting HRT. But this is clearly driven by malice against our community. And this has impacts not just on our mental health, because being unable to access things to treat one's gender dysphoria is a very serious drag on one's mental health and emotional well-being, but the risk of violence in our day-to-day lives goes up if we are not able to access this care. I've been in situations before, thankfully never in Ashland or Washburn, but where my safety depended on being able to pass. And we need to be careful that we're not saying that anyone's validity depends on their ability to be seen as their authentic gender, or that that should be the goal of every trans person. But as a practical matter, it often is a big help to our safety. Hmm. For example, if a trans kid is not able to access Lupron or other puberty blockers or delaying methods in conjunction with something their doctor thinks is appropriate, that means they are going to be at much higher risk of being targeted by transphobic or religious motivated violence if they, for example, are going to have to be trying to undo a puberty that's already happened.
Nora, as you hear Elise talk about the ripple effects on mental health, on health outcomes for gender-affirming care restrictions, what comes up for you, especially, you know, as a transgender woman?
Yeah, I mean, I think these executive orders are clearly part of a larger movement that is seeking to target transgender people in virtually every aspect of our public lives. I think there's very clearly, you know, this extremist movement that seeks to divide us and cause us as just as a larger community to distrust one another, to cast doubt on the needs of our neighbors and our families, and to really institute a culture of chaos and fear and uncertainty on the part of institutions. I think it is having a devastating effect on transgender people across the country. Top of my mind is just how important it is to resist the sort of culture of fear and uncertainty that this sort of extremist anti-trans movement is trying to institute. It is hard to sit with the pain and the anguish that is purposefully being inflicted on families and 18-year-old adults who are seeking gender-affirming care, 18-year-olds who have been looking forward to appointments for years and years, and having that ripped out from them a week before. The most rewarding aspect of doing this work is being able to mitigate that harm, to stop it from happening to more families. Being a part of resisting that culture of fear that I was talking about is one of the most rewarding aspects of the work that I'm able to do.
Nora, are advocates in a position to push back on these proposals, you know, whether that be at the state or the federal level? Are advocates, do they have the ability to influence at the moment?
Absolutely. I mean, I think from a legal perspective, you know, we have seen through this case and others, not just communities of trans people, but also communities of those who care for trans people, who love them. Organizations like PFLAG and organizations like GLAMA, that is organizations composed of medical professionals who provide for transgender people, who care for transgender people. Those actions have really made a difference. And I think we have also seen, you know, groundswells of support from just a popular perspective outside of the realm of litigation. You know, it's so important for us as a larger community, not just, you know, a community of transgender people or a community of families, but as a country, to voice our opposition to, you know, extremist anti-trans programs and movements, and to place our faith in one another and our neighbors, and not let politicians and extreme activists divide us and convince us to doubt each other.
We're talking about a turbulent time for transgender youth in Wisconsin and the nation, with efforts underway to limit gender-affirming health care. Nora Huppert is staff attorney at Lambda Legal. We're also joined by Elise Cayley, president of the Washburn-Shawamigan Bay PFLAG chapter in Wisconsin. Elise, what resources does your chapter offer your region? What support systems are out there that people might not recognize?
Well, the most important thing that our chapter does is provide an LGBT community space. About a year ago, we were able to open an office in downtown Ashland. And in our town, there really aren't any dedicated gay community centers or even gay bars. And it's really important that there's a place where a few times a month, anyone and everyone in the community can come in a family-appropriate space, play some board games. We have barbecues there sometimes. At the third Thursday of every month, we usually have a major educational event there. We were very fortunate to host the Wisconsin LGBT History Project. We also fundraise and offer scholarships for LGBT youth to attend colleges of their choice.
Why is having a common space to gather, to meet, so important?
Because a lot of us grow up thinking that for one reason or another, we are the only one. Because there is no one queer homeland, right? Mm. We crop up everywhere. And the most important thing for us to be able to live fulfilling lives is finding each other, just to be able to build a community of people who go through the same things, who experience some of the same things, people who experience different things and can learn from each other. Everyone needs to have a place where they can socialize safely. I'm particularly proud that we have sort of a community center model, even if it's only on a part-time basis at the moment, because historically, for a lot of us, the only option was in bar culture. And it's really, really helpful that not only do we have a space for LGBT people, but it's also a sober space.
Hmm. Thank you for that description. Nora, I want to turn back to the litigation here for a moment. And we're seeing bills that target transgender youth, not only at the federal level, but at the state level here in Wisconsin. Is it difficult for Lambda Legal to know how to approach these challenges and what to take to court?
I mean, I certainly think that there is an attack on all fronts on transgender people today. And we are keeping a close eye on every component of it. And, you know, we will never stop fighting for transgender people, for transgender youth and adults.
Elise, I'm going to give you the final word here. As states like Wisconsin aim to put restrictions on trans people, how is your mental health?
I spent most of yesterday trying to figure out if our insurance was still covering my husband's hormones. Kind of fried after that. For the moment, it looks like they are, but I imagine we'll be having that conversation just about every month for as long as we're both still here. Mm. More seriously, it's a pull between wanting to be supportive to people who are really, really struggling right now, but also trying to be aware of how bad it can get. And I know, this isn't the first big campaign against trans supportive healthcare that we've seen. You know, when the Institute for Sexual Science was destroyed in 1933 in Germany, you know, a lot of information was lost, and over the decades, we've clawed back to where we were before that loss, perhaps even a little bit further. And it's hard not to expect the worst, but I am really sustained by how wonderful my community is here. I've made a home here that I wasn't able to find in St. Louis or Beloit or anywhere else. There's still work to do, but I know that at the end of the day, I'm walking down the street here and people talk to me. I might be one of the weird ones in town, but I'm welcome here. I can go fishing with people. I can meet them for a drink. I can talk about cool birds that are hanging out. I can watch the incredible snowstorm we're having right now. And now I know what it feels like to be welcomed, and I'm all the more committed to building a world where everyone can feel like that. I love Ashland and the Shawamigan Bay, and it's a great place for me.
Well, Nora and Elise, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, thank you. This was really a great honor. Thank you.
That was Elise Cayley, president of the Washburn Shawamigan Bay PFLAG chapter in Wisconsin. PFLAG is part of the national organization that supports LGBTQ people and their families. And we heard from Nora Huppert, staff attorney at Lambda Legal, part of a court challenge opposing President Trump's executive orders toward transgender patients under 19. We've been talking about a lawsuit filed this month on behalf of families with transgender children who say their health care has already been compromised by the president's orders. And you can be part of this conversation and share your story. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, two new Wisconsin sheriffs share the challenges facing their departments that include staffing concerns.
Everyone in our region's competing for the same individuals, and the pool of applicants is lower.
Meet two new sheriffs in town. That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Farad.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Two newly appointed sheriffs are leading their county departments after working their entire careers in their Wisconsin communities.
Sheriff Craig Rukoff of Grant County and Sheriff Kerry Curran of Clark County have more than 50 years of combined experience in law enforcement. County sheriff is an elected position. Both were appointed to the office by the governor after their predecessors moved on from the job.
Both regions, while 150 miles apart, are experiencing ongoing challenges with staffing, illegal drug enforcement, and transporting unhoused individuals with mental health needs.
Craig Rukoff is sheriff of Grant County in southwestern Wisconsin. Kerry Curran, sheriff of Clark County in north central Wisconsin. Sheriff Curran, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
And Sheriff Rukoff, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Now, you are both long-timers, I understand, with your departments. I want to hear a little bit about your careers as Sheriff Rukoff, starting with you. You're going back 25 years with the department there in Grant County. Can you talk a little bit about your time in the Sheriff's Department leading up to this appointment?
Yeah, sure. So actually, in June, I'll have been here 27 years.
Wow.
I started full-time back in 1998 when I was hired to work as a jailer in our jail. Then after about 9 months, I was hired to out on patrol as a deputy. Did that, and then I spent a big chunk of my career as a detective working criminal investigations, which I really enjoyed. And then after a period of time, I promoted to sergeant and went back out on patrol as a patrol sergeant, and then spent about a year doing that. And then I took a lateral as the detective sergeant, and then I was promoted to captain and the jail administrator, where I spent about 3 years there. And I was there when I was appointed by Governor Evers to be the next sheriff back in October when Sheriff Dreckman resigned to become our first county administrator.
And Sheriff Kern, you've got a similar long career in Clark County.
Yes, I started as a reserve deputy July of 1991 while I was going through college at that time for police science. And ultimately, I was hired full-time in March of 1993 as a communications corrections deputy. I worked in that position until approximately May of 1996 when I became a patrol officer. And then I was promoted to detective in December of 1998, where I spent a majority of my career in a detective division. I specialized in child maltreatment cases, sensitive crimes, primarily worked a lot of crime, a majority of crimes against person. Cases until I was promoted to detective captain in March of 2019. And then ultimately, when Sheriff Haynes retired, I was appointed as sheriff January 1st of 2025.
Now, clearly, you both know your territory. Sheriff Curran, what does your long experience there tell you about Clark County and the needs, maybe the unique needs of the sheriff's department in your neck of the woods?
The biggest thing that I have found coming into this position, and actually I've noticed it the last couple of years, was recruitment and retention of employees. When I had first started, there were probably 60 applicants that applied for the same position. And now we're lucky to get three applicants for one patrol position. So that is probably one of the biggest things that has changed over the years. In addition, the mental health issues, the opioid crisis has become a significant problem for us in the last 10 years or so.
Sheriff Rukoff, let's say with that staffing issues, that's something you are facing in Grant County.
Yeah, you know, as Sheriff Kern talked about, you know, we're struggling, you know, with some of the same situations that they have. I mean, you look at, you know, now we're everyone in our region's competing for the same individuals, and the, you know, the pool of applicants is lower, less and less all the time. I think there's going to be a rebound coming. Currently in our agency, we are actually almost up to full staff. We're just short one female jailer right now, which we're in the process of doing interviews of for those to fill that position. But, you know, right now we're technically in a good spot, but, you know, really sometimes if you can keep somebody for a year or two, you're doing really well. But we're all competing for the same individuals. So we're just, you know, we're trying to figure out what we can do internally to retain those individuals, you know, so trying to improve our culture and you know, figuring out what we can do to maintain our staffing.
And Sheriff Rukoff, are there ways you think to maybe reach out to the community, start building a pipeline for those high school kids who may never have thought of, you know, hey, the sheriff's department might be a career for me?
Yeah, absolutely. So we currently attend like career fairs at the high schools. We work closely with Southwest Technical College in Fenimore, Wisconsin. That's just right up the road from us, and UW-Platteville. And so we actually get a lot of our part-time help from people in the criminal justice programs at both institutions, and a lot of times those lead to full-time positions. So we're fortunate to have both of those schools in Grant County, and we have a lot of our staff that teach at Southwest Tech, our instructors, so that helps with the recruiting process as well. But most of the time, if you have, you know, the kids that are going through the law enforcement academy, I say kids, but most of them are, you know, they're adults, but, you know, most of them are already hired, so there aren't very many pre-service students anymore.
And Sheriff Kern, are you doing similar kinds of outreach?
Yes, we are. Unfortunately, we do not have a law enforcement technical college in our county, but there are three of them in surrounding counties around us. In fact, next week, our patrol captain is planning on going to the current recruit class in a neighboring county to try and recruit employees.
And Sheriff Kern, we heard Sheriff Rukoff say there almost to full staffing levels. Are you short right now, maybe to the point where, you know, you're stretched a little more thin than you'd like to be with providing service?
We are. When I first was appointed sheriff, we were 11 positions short. And once I was appointed, that created some more movement in the higher ranks of our department. However, we just hired three patrol officers here 2 weeks ago.
We are talking with a couple of Wisconsin's newest sheriffs appointed to talk about challenges in their departments. We've got Sheriff Craig Rukoff of Grant County, Sheriff Kerry Kern of Clark County. Want to look at some issues people may see in the news these days that relate to your department. A lot of attention, of course, lately on immigration and how local law enforcement agencies cooperate, executive orders from the White House on immigration policies, some legislation maybe in the works here in the state as well. Sheriff Kern, is this something, how you deal with federal immigration enforcement officers, has this been an issue for you in recent months?
It has not been an issue so far. However, our primary function is protection of the citizens of Clark County. And, when we work with our federal partners, we've always had a good relationship with them. And I envision that we will continue to have an excellent working relationship.
And Sheriff Rukoff, how about you in Grant County?
Yeah, here in Grant, we haven't, hasn't really come up yet. I mean, I've fielded a few questions from some community members, things like that. But, we have not changed the way we do business based on the change in administration. And we haven't adjusted any of our policies related to immigration. Our policy ensures that all individuals receive equal enforcement of the law and equal access to services, regardless of their citizenship or immigration status. So basically what I tell people, what that means is everyone has the right to seek law enforcement assistance. And just because we are investigating criminal activity, that doesn't automatically involve inquiries into a person's immigration status. But I also, tell people that we do work closely with our federal partners and we'll continue to do that. And there may be some cases where, an individual's immigration status becomes relevant to a specific investigation and we may reach out to our federal partners for situations like that. But, in reality, for me, it in my opinion, it doesn't matter if someone's a U.S. citizen or not. If they're out in our communities committing crimes, we don't want them here anyway. So that, that's what I tell people.
Another concern you both actually flagged for us, Sheriff Rukoff, transporting people who are homeless, who don't have housing and who have a mental health need, maybe on an emergency basis, maybe not. What kind of things are you and your deputies and your staff dealing with there?
This is a big issue, and it's actually a statewide issue, and it's a major drain on resources, especially for, the smaller agencies. When we're dealing with emergency detentions or people who are suffering a mental health crisis, I feel these, most of them, a lot of the times, are medical issues and shouldn't be law enforcement issues. Unfortunately, where we get involved is because these are tied to some sort of transportation. If they don't have someone to help with transportation, a lot of times it turns into an emergency detention, and then that's where law enforcement ends up getting involved, and we're required to provide that transportation. And here in Southwest Wisconsin, we're consistently seeing, very long hospital stays due to medical clearance issues or trying to find a facility that has an open bed. And we're consistently seeing, sits at the hospital for 12 hours or more. And then those individuals who are suffering a mental health crisis, are there not getting the help that they need. And then our transportation where we have to take them is generally 2 to 3 hours away. So then we have to put them in a car and transport them 2 to 3 hours, depending on, which facility has an open bed. So if you think about that, you have someone who's in a mental health crisis, it takes them that long to get to a location to help them, and it's just tying up so many resources, and those individuals aren't getting the help that they need. And so, it's leaving these smaller agencies with communities without coverage.
And Sheriff Kern, what does that look like in Clark County?
We are feeling the same thing. Our provider is about 2 to 3 hours away, and a lot of times, they have to get these patients have to get medically cleared to begin with, and that ties up an officer sitting at the hospital. From there, they have to get transported that 2 to 3 hours, and then, of course, there is the return trip. On occasion, since we are short-staffed, we have contracted with private transport companies to fill that gap for us. However, here in the last couple of weeks, we've utilized some of our administrative staff take on some of those transports and responsibilities.
Another concern facing some communities around the state are longer jail stays, and sometimes because of long court backlogs. Now, back in January here on the show, we talked about a new jail pod going up in Brown County near Green Bay. County Executive Troy Streckenbach discussed having inmates in jail for, in some cases, more than 2 years because of a backlog in circuit court cases there. Here's a listen to what he had to say.
We're well aware of the stress that counties throughout the state of Wisconsin are experiencing with the lack of funding to the overall court system, the public defender's office, the district attorney's office. I think Wisconsin Counties Association has made a very strong argument that our court system funding has not kept up with inflation.
Now, I understand this may look different from county to county. Sheriff Kern, let's start with you. Are you seeing these kind of backlogs and longer jail stays in Clark County?
We have not. I know there, at times there have been backlogs in our circuit court system. However, I don't know of any lengthy stays that anybody has had.
And Sheriff Rukoff, how about you in Grant County?
So Sharon, that was the first time, you know, I had heard that information you shared. But I would agree with Sheriff Kern. Here in Grant County, we've had some long stays, but it's just generally been, you know, a year-long jail sentence or something along those lines. I would say that our court system, our judges, and our district attorney's office, you know, kind of pride themselves on keeping things moving through the system so we don't have that issue. They're extremely busy, and I know they're strained. Probably our district attorney's office could probably use some additional help.
Finally, I want to talk to you both about drug issues. When I've talked to first responders over the past bunch of years, I hear again and again how the job has changed, how much, depending on where you are in the state, how much more Narcan administration for opioid overdoses is part of the picture. When I talk to people in law enforcement, some communities are worried more about opioid at any given time, others more about meth at any given time. Sheriff Rukoff, let's start with you in Grant County. When it comes to drug-related issues, what are you seeing?
I guess our biggest issue I think that we're seeing right now is the methamphetamine, fentanyl issue that we're dealing with. You know, we get people, and you can talk about recidivism. We get a lot of that with people from that population that have been through the court system and, you know, a probation violation or things like that. It's just so hard for them to get out of that situation. And so we see a lot of reoccurring offenses from individuals from that community.
And just to be clear, you said methamphetamine and fentanyl. Is it the same people using both substances at the same time or sequentially? What kind of things are you seeing?
I would say a little bit of both and a little bit of everything, kind of, the way we see it. Sometimes mm-hmm. that fentanyl is laced in a lot of different things,
right.
And, you know, different types of drugs. So, yes, we're seeing some of the same individuals that are dealing with the, you know, both of those situations. And then it also ties into other substances as well.
And how about you, Sheriff Kern in Clark County?
The opioid crisis is certainly plaguing us. Since 2019, we've had 10 or 12 overdose deaths that had occurred in Clark County. Majority of the investigations involve opioids. However, there are some methamphetamine cases in addition to cocaine cases. Cocaine seems to be coming back to our area.
I would agree with Sheriff Kern on that as well. It's not that we're not seeing, you know, the opioid overdoses or, you know, things like that, but mainly the main thing we're seeing is the methamphetamine. But yeah, the opioid stuff's out there as well.
We'll leave it there. Sheriff Rukoff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And Sheriff Kern, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Sheriff Kerry Kern of Clark County and Sheriff Craig Rukoff of Grant County. I talked to them last week about their new jobs as sheriffs.
A couple days back, we shared a story from a listener who remembers growing up with WPR's Let's Sing in music class as a kid.
Ken in Eau Claire heard that and emailed a memory. Ken writes, I remember when I was 10, our teacher would have us listen to one of the educational programs on Wisconsin School of the Air. One day, we were asked to write a poem about how a Wisconsin town got its name. Well, I chose Beaver Dam, and I remember the first few lines of my poem.
Here it goes. There once was a town called Weavers until it was taken over by Beavers. There were beavers here and everywhere.
Ken's poem was read on the air, and Ken says he remembers how excited he was to hear that poem on the air.
And Ken went on to write a book and is a field editor for our Wisconsin magazine. Ken says, I think maybe WPR got me started in my enjoyment of writing.
Thanks, Ken. Share your WPR memories and stories. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.